And welcome to Comicast, Warpcast episode 42. This episode, we will not be discussing World's Finest Superman and Batman, nor will we discuss All-Star Comics or Amazing Fantasy. We will discuss non-hero comics, such as Lobo, Wolverine, and The Punisher. Oh, wait, those are anti-hero comics, my bad. I mean non-super-powered comics, like Andrew Dice Clay, Dennis Leary, and Rodney Dangerfield. I don't get no respect. Today, I'd like to introduce you to the least super person that I know, Twerpcast executive producer, James Caswell.
And he's Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Twerps, and Alan Moore's second biggest fan. Alan Moore's biggest fan is, of course, Alan Moore.
Thank you for joining us with Twerpcast once again. This episode marks the release of the movie Red, with an all-star cast featuring Bruce Willis, Mary Louise Parker, Morgan Freeman, Helen Mirren, and John Malkovich. With the release of this movie, we thought it would be a good idea to talk about non-superhero-specific comic books, and how these are becoming a source of inspiration for the movie industry.
This is probably also going to end up being part one of two, as somewhere down the line, we're also going to take a look at literature and how it is often used to inspire Hollywood. Now, Doug, you said something about non-superhero comic books? Is there really such a thing?
No, there's not.
He jests, folks, really.
Really, I do. This is actually a really good question. I think our friends out there who are familiar and enjoy the four-color comics probably know a little bit of the background, and we're just going to share some more of that. Comics themselves actually started out in publishing back in the 1800s as part of the funny pages.
There were some newspaper companies out there who realized that the comic strips that they would print in their Sunday morning newspaper were actually really popular among their audience, and they realized that they could make a little bit of extra money if they took those comics and reprinted them in a book by themselves without any of that unnecessary news stuff.
Yes. Nowadays, newspapers just print advertisements, none of the unnecessary news stuff.
These reprints of the funny pages became known as comic books. A lot of times they would actually be reprinted in hardcover or in magazine style, which is what would later become the norm. It wasn't until the late 1930s that superheroes actually took over the comic book industry.
I'm thinking of comics from this new time period, the early 1900s, that have really impacted what the comic industry is today. You're talking about your Little Abners, your Little Orphan Annies, Beetle Bailey, Blondie. These things have all been around way past 50 years. And when you look at them, there is a start of some superheroes out there. You've got your Flash Gordon, you've got Buck Rogers, even Dick Tracy to a certain extent. You really have these heroic people that are out there. It's just the cost of the comic superhero.
Now, back when the Spirit movie came out, we talked a little bit about how Denny Cole was going to be a rough-and-tumble detective up until the point where the comic books basically got taken over by the superheroes, and Denny's publisher said, we don't want to do a hard-boiled detective story, we want to do a superhero story. So Will Eisner drew a mask on Denny Cole and called him the Spirit.
And this comes about basically in the late 1930s, where there's really this rise in the masked hero. You've got Superman and Batman, and you've got even something like Captain Marvel, which is arguably just a ripoff of Superman. It's another one of the costumed superheroes. The Daily Comics, of course, are still out there. Little Orphan Annie runs practically forever. You've got Brenda Starr, you've got Peanuts, you've got Lee Fox, the Phantom. These things don't disappear, but comic books explode, and there are other types of comics out there. Batman appeared in Detective Comics, and Spider-Man will eventually appear in Amazing Fantasy. There are science fiction comics, and there are horror comics, but the leader of the industry now is the costumed superhero.
And that still holds true today. 99 times out of 100, when somebody refers to comic books, they're talking about the superhero genre. But there is now that 1% that has made a comeback. The predominant use of graphics to tell non-hero stories started to reemerge in the 1980s. It didn't really begin to gain acceptance until the 1990s, when the graphic novel reprints started to really take off.
This was a genius move in marketing. You're getting into the 80s, and so many of the places that once upon a time regularly carried comics are no longer carrying them. I remember as a kid, I could go into any drugstore and sit there for hours reading the comics in their magazine rack. But by the time the 80s are out, bookstores, they don't want to touch this. For that matter, the drugstores don't want to touch it anymore.
Primarily because they had kids standing around in their aisles for hours on end reading the comic books and not really buying them.
Yes, the term, this ain't a lending library, comes to mind. But somebody comes up with the idea, if you printed it in a book format, it slapped an ISBN number on there. The bookstores could actually carry them in their backlist. And this is actually different from the digests. For years, comic book publishers have known that you could throw a whole bunch of reprints with one new story and call it a digest. But a digest was printed as a magazine and went on the magazine rack. If you take the digest, throw an ISBN number on it, it's now a book. Or, as the industry prefers, it's a graphic novel.
And while a lot of the comic book companies did, in fact, take advantage of this to reprint stories of Superman and Batman and Spider-Man, they also saw this as an opportunity to draw in the non-superhero audience by printing stories of a non-superhero nature. Stories that would later lend themselves quite readily to the big screen. These stories typically ran as a limited series and had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and were not meant to be a long-run series. After they had a run as individual comics, they'd be gathered together and put out as a graphic novel. And a lot of times, that's where these comics would actually make their money.
Some of these graphic novels that have been made into movies, you probably recognize their titles quite easily. Got Virus, From Hell with Johnny Depp, Ghost World, Monkey Bone, Road to Perdition with Tom Hanks,
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen with the awesome Sean Connery, American Splendor, Bulletproof Monk, V for Vendetta
with Natalie Portman,
A History of Violence, 300, Stardust, 30 Days of Night, The Surrogates from last year, along with Whiteout, and just this year we've seen Scott Pilgrim vs. the World and The Losers.
Now, you can argue that some of these movies already were losers. Some did better than others. Some were incredible but didn't do well. Surrogates, which is probably one of the best sci-fi movies to come out in that year, just wasn't a hit.
Very true. Some movies should have been big blockbusters, but really fizzled badly when it came to being in theaters.
Actually, I think recently that Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, that should have been a hit. That had everything going for it. Had a hot star, had a director whose films are just incredible.
Great word of mouth.
It had only one problem.
Nobody would go to see it.
Yep, you couldn't get any butts in the seats.
But there are some that have been incredibly successful as well. 300, V for Vendetta.
30 Days of Night did very well. Which is amazing that anybody could go see a movie with Josh Hartnett in it.
I actually did go and see The Losers, and it was a pretty decent story. I thought it was a pretty decent story back in the 80s when it was called The A-Team. But besides that, it was an okay film.
I think that brings us to the most recent graphic novel made to film, Red. Red stands for Retired and Extremely Dangerous. A quick plug for what this movie would be is it's space cowboys, except the retired CIA agents.
I heard one person refer to it as The Expendables on Geritol.
Yeah, but these actors actually can act.
Good point. They don't rely on their muscles for their acting ability.
So, Jim, what are your overall thoughts on the movie?
Well, my first thought is that Bruce Willis is quickly becoming the next Sean Connery in my eyes. Sean Connery, for the longest time, has been able to improve a movie at least a full pen in the pocket protector just by being in the film. And Bruce Willis is quickly becoming that same type of star. It doesn't matter if it's campy. It doesn't matter if it's got holes in its script big enough to drive a freight train through. If he's in it, he adds a certain level of fun and excitement to it that just makes it better.
High praise for Bruce Willis. Okay, this is going to shock all our regular listeners out there, but this movie had gunfights, car chases, and explosions in it.
So you hated it.
Oh, God, this is so terrible. Say I'm easy to please.
You're easy. To please.
That's what I like in a movie. This movie is not going to contend for an Oscar. although it has Oscar winners in it, this movie's not going to contend for Pulitzer. It's simply entertaining. I don't think they tried to be anything more than entertaining with this movie.
And it's definitely not going to be nominated for the Peace Prize. The basic outline of the story is that Bruce Willis plays Frank Moses, a retired CIA operative who was, without a doubt, one of the best of the best. Gee, big surprise there. But he is retired. He's gotten out of the biz and is trying to make a life for himself away from the bullets, the car chases, the explosions. Just as he's starting to make a life for himself, though, including trying to establish a relationship with Sarah, who's played by Mary Louise Parker, he finds himself on the receiving end of a hit squad, which he quickly dispatches in about, 25 seconds? He's getting old. It takes him a little longer. So, in order to find out what's going on and why this is happening, he not only has to save the girl, but go to some of his old CIA comrades and contacts to discover why he and his old CIA buddies are getting whacked and who's behind it. Some of said CIA buddies include Morgan Freeman, Helen Mirren, and John Malkovich. Talk about your loaded deck. All the while, he's being chased by one of the new best of the best, played by Carl Urban. Yes, Dr. McCoy from Star Trek.
I have to say, that was kind of a little sweet spot in the movie for me. I like Carl Urban. I don't know where he came from. I know I really enjoyed his performance as Dr. McCoy, and even though he was the antagonist in this movie, he still offered an excellent performance. Bruce Willis does impress me as an actor. I think his ability to play both the action role and the comedy side and make it believable, it's an incredible thing to watch.
Even as far back as the Die Hard films, Bruce has had this unique knack of being able to be the common man and the Superman at the same time, and make you not want to question how he's able to survive all these explosions and so forth. You're just along for the ride, and you enjoy it. Sprinklers in the limo! Can you freaking believe it?
I love Hudson Hawk. Mary Louise Parker. Not just a pretty face. She has really good chemistry with Bruce Willis in this movie. I really bought into the May-September relationship between the two of them, and actually gained an ounce of respect for Mary Louise Parker higher than I already had.
The fact that there is an obvious age difference between the two, and I don't think it's as big as the movie made it out to be. I think Bruce is in his 50s now. I think Mary Louise Parker is in her late 30s, maybe early 40s. So that isn't a huge gap. It's not like a Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones type relationship.
Or a Demi Moore-Aston Kutcher relationship.
Yes, one of Bruce's favorite children.
Well, it comes down to it. I mean, Morgan Freeman can do no wrong. For me, I don't really know Helen Mirren that well, but I thought she did a fine job.
It was fun watching Helen Mirren having fun with her image. Because she normally plays these prim and proper British debutante type characters. Even when she's stripping off all of her clothes, she still has this air of almost British royalty to her. And when she gets introduced in the film, she's doing a flower arrangement in this grand hall dining room. But then you swiftly learn that she's got an Uzi tucked underneath the table. She's able to laugh at her own image, and that, to me, provided a level of respect for her.
John Malkovich, honestly, I think I either love him or hate him, depending on the role that he's in. Being John Malkovich, I loved him. And Aragon, I hated him.
John Malkovich is a great character actor. He takes great direction. The problem is that sometimes the direction that he gets really sucks, and therefore he's stuck playing a character that you're not going to like. In this case, he was given an absolutely insane role to play, and he did a fantastic job with it.
It was definitely quite insane. I enjoyed the cast and I enjoyed their acting. And that's not to say that the script was three-dimensional and all of these characters were fully believable and it was so wonderful. They were absolutely flat. This is a movie where if you're a crazy man, you're a crazy man. If you're a bad guy, you're a bad guy. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's just simple, silly entertainment.
Actually, I'm going to argue with you on that point, because while it isn't fully three-dimensional, it's not as two-dimensional as, say, a comic book either. there are some times where you get to see a little bit of what has made these characters these characters. The relationship between Helen Mirren and her love interest is told in bits and pieces here and there, and it actually allows you to see what the life of these retired spies was like back in the day, the pressures that they were under. The reason that Frank Moses is just now finding love is actually explained that he never wanted to draw anybody into the life that he had to live. Even Carl Urban's character becomes a bit three-dimensional when you start to see what his life is like outside of the office, and when it gets used against him.
I think what you're really talking about is the backstory. You're learning what Helen Mirren did many years ago. You're learning what Bruce Willis did years ago. I think the closest thing to the three-dimensional character really is the Carl Urban character. At the beginning of the movie, he starts out, "I follow orders without question." He's a drone and a lackey. By the end of the movie, you see him beginning to open up his eyes and that he can be something more than just a lackey. Whereas I would say the movie really did make an attempt to round out this character and make him more than just something flat. There's only so much that you can do, honestly, in this script, and I don't think they try to. There's no great drama. There's no great to be or not to be for his character. It's just, okay, I'm something more now than I was then.
I didn't say it should be nominated for an Oscar. I just said that it wasn't as flat as a comic book.
Even comic books have backstories.
At least until the next writer comes along and decides, oh, I don't like that piece of the backstory. I'm going to completely ignore it or absolutely destroy it and salt the earth.
Oh, I love John Byrne. He's one of my favorite authors.
Well, at least in that regard, I think J.T. Kroll is actually trying to give John Byrne a run for his money.
Good luck, Green Arrow, and Teen Titans.
I would like to be able to say nice things about Julian McMahon. I mean, if you want to talk about comic book movies, he was Dr. Doom in both Fantastic Four movies. But of all the character, he really is the most two-dimensional out of all of them. And he's only on the screen for maybe a half hour, with maybe a dozen lines through the whole film. So he makes a great set piece.
Well, what do you think of the directing of this, Jim?
Well, it was directed by Robert Schwenke, whose best known piece of work is probably The Time Traveler's Wife, which I actually sat down and watched a couple weeks ago on HBO. And it was actually a better film than I had anticipated it being.
I watched this while I was in the hospital, and I was tied to the bed, which is an absolute truth in both cases. I really enjoyed The Time Traveler's Wife. I thought it was a really moving chick flick. And if I were into chick flicks, I would give it incredible, incredible review.
It did have a whole lot more in common with chick flicks than it ever would to science fiction.
It was certainly not meant to be a science fiction piece. It was a chick flick with a science fiction plot. If this had been a sci-fi movie, I probably would have given it 4 pens. As it's a chick flick, I have to take one away. I can only give it 3 pens.
You either take away a pen, or we take away a man card.
Exactly. In all seriousness, I really liked it. I feel now that I've accepted that, and I've admitted it, now I can probably start recovering.
The first step is always admitting that you have a problem.
But that being said, moving forward to the new movie, Red, I think he did an okay job with the material he had. Saying that this is never going to be nominated for an Oscar pretty much tells you exactly where it is. Some of the subtle stuff that I liked were transitions between the scenes. There was just some very stylized nature to these transitions, which I found very appealing. There were certain shots in the movie which had an extremely comic book feel to them, and even though I haven't read the graphic novel, I'd be willing to believe that they were shot almost panel for panel compared to the original graphic novel. A particular scene comes to mind when John Malkovich uses a single shot from his handgun to blow up a round that's being fired at him from a rocket-propelled grenade.
Another scene that's been in the advertising is Frank Moses stepping out of the police car, stepping forward as the back end is swinging towards him, and it swings behind him as he steps out of the way. If that wasn't in the comic book, it was meant to make you think of a comic book.
And I think both these things that I've mentioned, the comic book feel and these interesting transitions, I think add to the appeal of this movie.
There were some choices that he made that almost took me out of the moment. Times that he moved away from the Steadicam and almost looked like he switched over to a handheld camcorder so that the movement was kind of bouncy and choppy. I don't know if he was trying to make you feel as though you were actually there and a part of it, or what the idea was behind it, but it just was too bouncy and choppy and kind of made me a little bit motion sick. But that could have easily just been a decision that was made in the editing room, too.
Yeah, I hate when movies are directed in the editing room. That really is something awful that no director should have to sit through. That's a topic for another Perpcast. I enjoyed this movie. I got my 2 hours worth of entertainment out of it. I got my car chases, gunfights, and explosions. I don't have anything to complain and say, this was bad. I just can't also say, this was great. This was the most fun that I'd ever had. I'd give it 2 pens in the pocket protector. That's not to say that it's a terrible movie. It's just not saying that it's a great movie.
I agree that it was a fun movie. It wasn't the most fun ever had, but I definitely am glad that I saw it. I recommend that you see it. I cannot, in good conscience, say you have to run out and drop $8.50, $10, $12 to go see it at a nighttime showing. If you can see it at the matinee showing, or if you decide to wait until it comes out on video, I can't blame you.
I would totally Redbox this movie.
Yeah, definitely a Netflixer. But I do recommend that you see it. Sit down, pop yourself up some popcorn, kick back, and enjoy some explosions and some laughter. That was another thing about this movie, is that there were some scenes where I was just really laughing. I was the only one in the theater laughing, but I was really laughing at it.
I will vouch for that. There were scenes where he was the only one in the theater laughing. There were some campy, humorous bits that I think maybe threw people off in the movie. It is what it is. If you enjoy camp, then you'll enjoy the silly camp scenes.
Which explains why I was laughing, but it doesn't explain why you were laughing. Or were you laughing on the inside? Where it counts.
I was certainly laughing on the inside.
So there you have it. 2 pens from Doug, 2.5 pens from myself, with a recommendation to at least rent. It's a short one today, but a sweet one, folks. Thank you for joining us.
As always, we appreciate you listening to Twerpcast, and we encourage your feedback. Please write jim@twerponline.net. We can also be found on Facebook, MySpace, Zanga, and Twitter.
Doug often says, we encourage your feedback. I want to add to that, we really encourage your feedback. We would love to hear back from you. Let us know what you think about all of our shows. This has been a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2010.
Airbags, can you freaking believe it?